Ta-da! Good evening, everybody. Welcome. John Henry Soto here, along with George Batista. Welcome to Counterparts. Very excited tonight. We have Kelly Hall Tompkins going to be on the show. We're going to be talking about so much stuff. I mean, we just had about a five-minute conversation about so many things, and I'm so thrilled to bring this to you. It's going to be tremendously valuable and inspiring. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. All righty, and there's our little theme song. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you danced. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. George, how are you?
I'm fantastic and excited to have this conversation today.
Yes, it's going to be a lot of fun. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Kelly, and we'll bring her on.
Right. Oh, definitely, definitely. So Kelly Hall Tompkins, what can we say? She's a professional violinist and the founder of Music Kitchen Food for the Soul, a program that lifts the spirits of homeless New Yorkers through live classical music recitals. She has also performed as the fiddler as a violin soloist in the Grammy and Tony nominated Broadway revival production of Fiddler on the Roof. She has also appeared as soloist with orchestras, including Dallas Symphony, Oakland Symphony, Jacksonville Symphony, just to name a few. And in addition to numerous concerts and recitals and in cities all around the world, she is acclaimed by the New York Times as the versatile violinist who makes the music come alive, and as a 2017 New York Times New Yorker of the Year for her tonal mastery and groundbreaking recording projects. And John, I know you are as excited as I am to speak with her. So let's do it. Let's bring out, ladies and gentlemen, Kelly Hall Tompkins.
Ooh.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for doing this. We really, really appreciate you being on the show. It's been a week of watching and learning so much about you, and not just the amazing music and the accomplishments, but also the things that you do with your music outside of like the major concert halls. I just thought that was so inspiring to me. And as somebody who works in that industry as well, it was just really just incredible. So I'm really looking forward to having a conversation here and just having an hour of good chat. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks very much for your interest and thanks for inviting me on.
Absolutely. So, as I said, George is like the professional one. He has all these professional questions.
Yeah, right.
Go for it, George.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to start. You know, when you were young, obviously you were drawn to this music. I know you had support from your family. You know, your mom, I know, was a huge support, you know, and I know you got exposed to classical music as young. And I know also you've talked about in the past, like cartoons, like actually you got inspiration from cartoons and stuff like
that.
That's right. What was it about this music that called you? Because sometimes I say sometimes, right, that sometimes music picks you, like sometimes you don't pick the music. What was it about this music that drew you in?
Oh, it lifted me up. It inspired my imagination. I loved the dance of it. I loved the lyricism. I loved the bass lines. I loved the choreography in terms of the cartoons. I loved the match with the choreography of the animation.
Yeah, right.
I also grew up Lutheran. So just hearing the Baroque music of Bach, all of it together, I think I sifted the music out of my environment, from commercials, from, you know, from church, from Warner Brothers cartoons, just all of it. I really, I just was taken with it. Mm-hmm. And it felt like a language that I need.
Did we lose her?
Uh-oh. She just froze there.
Uh oh! Did we lose Kelly?
Oh, there she is. Okay,
She's back. For a second there.
Okay. So we lost you at the music The cartoons. What was the last thing?
Well, the choreography, the
right.
I just felt called by all of it. You know, both is I sifted the music out of my environment everywhere that I was, whether it was Saturday morning cartoons on TV or Sunday morning Baroque music on at church or commercials. I mean, I think I was in the same environment as all the rest of my friends in elementary school, but I'm the one that looked for the music everywhere I could find it. So when I finally went to hear, I think we had an organized trip to go hear the local orchestra in my town in Greenville, South Carolina. And I was just hanging over the balcony, watching them play. And then when a string quartet came to my elementary school, I was done. I was like, that's what I want to do.
Awesome. I was going to ask you, like, when was it that the strings hit you? But that was it.
Well, it was 9 years. When I was 9 years old, I think I can't remember if it was the very same year that I started or if it was the spring before I actually got to take the classes. I'm not sure. Yeah. But it was pretty fast.
Yeah. Yeah. You always remember that, too. Like, I remember because I grew up in a Spanish family. I'm from New York. I'm from the Bronx. And my grandfather would play these amazing songs with this great guitar, you know, Spanish guitar. But then I heard Santana on the radio once, and I was like, what is that? Right. I want that in my life, you know?
Yeah.
And then from that moment on, the guitar and that sound just became, it's just an amazing thing that you just, it's hard to explain.
Yeah.
But it is just something that you just can't. It's like George is a drummer, an amazing drummer. And he just took to hitting things.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. It's true. And I music, like for me, and I, you know, I maybe for you, music was always in my life as a child. My mother used to tell me stories that when she would put the washing machine on, I would stand there and just rock to it. And so she always kind of knew that I was going to do something in music, you know. So, but it's just calling that you have that you just it's always there. No matter what, even when I'm not playing, I want to be playing. You know, it's that type of thing. So it's an amazing feeling.
Yeah,
it really is. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask
one question too. But anyway.
Oh, is he? Oh, nice. Yeah. Very good. Excellent. And George and I are cousins.
I saw that.
So we played a long. So we have a lot of stories. You know, we keep the embarrassing ones quiet. That's kind of like our. We have that rivalry between each other. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about like your first, you know, because playing at that level that you play in, you know, there's a moment that you really need to kind of focus. And we see a lot of artists today with the TikToks and the stuff. And, you know, it seems like you can be famous within like 10 seconds of doing a little dance or something and not realizing that the level of work that's needed and the commitment to play at that level, it's so intense, you know, that I get nervous sometimes. And we talk about this on the show a lot. We're losing that idea that the intensity needed to play at that level is this. It's not whatever you see on this, on the little box. You know, the box is fun, but it's not real life, you know. How's your process when you were studying at the beginning? Did you do the religious rehearsals, the 10-hour rehearsals, or were you more free, or were you just born completely talented with skill?
Well, that's a really interesting perspective comparing like just the tools of today and whatnot and how people envision success. And I do think I have come to learn in my life that there's no one path.
Right.
You know, that people get to various places different ways. However, I totally believe what you're saying. And it would be a shame if we lose the sense of focus that requires to master something at a high level. That's not a 10 minute TikTok video. It's true.
Right.
The thing that I learned over time is that in my field, people tend to start at particularly violin or a piano tend to start at age 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I started at 9, but it was, I used to be so self-conscious about that for years. But until I was actually it was until not until I was on an interview on MSNBC alongside Misty Copeland, who started at 14.
Right.
I officially put that to bed. And I was like, okay, right, now I see. People do different things differently, and there's no one way. And I also came to understand that passion about something is so much more powerful than someone saying, you should do this. And so I'm glad that I came to it on my own and I didn't have somebody say, you should do this. Right. Because I think I came to it sort of fired up and ready to shoot through a cannon.
Right.
And I had to do a lot of work to, you know, and my mom and I were exposed to the path, really, that you have to take. And we learned it together, like piece by piece. Like, oh, okay. I didn't have private lessons for the first 5 years of playing the violin. I only played in a elementary school strings class. Then somebody came along and said, you should audition for the youth orchestra. And yes, we definitely want you in the youth orchestra, but you should be having private lessons. Call these people. And, you know, and then at that point, things just really started to go on a fast trajectory. And, you know, I went to the next level teacher and I entered the pre-college program. And the teacher said, you're one of the best violinists in the country in your age group. You should be studying at places like Tanglewood in the summer.
Wow.
And
right.
You know, I went to Tanglewood and then I went to Aspen. And then it was a question of where to go to college. And in my family, you know, my mom was used to great universities. And I was like, but I want to go to a conservatory. And this is what that looks like. But not knowing exactly what kind of it. I mean, I wanted a rigorous education and I wanted to make sure that it was very complete and you know, not light on anything. So I wasn't sure what that looked like. So I cast a wide net. I auditioned for 9 schools and my mom took me to every single one of them. I think everyone except one or maybe all of them. I think actually it was all of them.
Wow.
And yeah, so I really had a wide selection process and I went into it with my eyes open and I chose the Eastman School of Music to do my undergrad, and then I did my master's at Manhattan School. I had gotten into Juilliard as well and full scholarship at Manhattan School, so you know,
wow,
the choice was clear. But yeah, it's a process, it's a path. I didn't, when I was a kid, I didn't necessarily know how to practice right away. But what I did, I think, was also powerful. I just wanted to be able to play it the way that I could hear it. That's all I wanted. That's all I wanted. I just wanted to be able to play it the way I wanted to hear it.
Right.
The way I was hearing it in my mind. And so that was the carrot at the end of the stick that I never could quite catch up with. And that's what kept me chasing. And I think that plus the addition, you know, of private lessons, plus the addition of these summer camps just made me kind of shoot like a cannon, even with a more of a late start, because I just had the passion for it.
I love it. And you mentioned shoot like a cannon. It's important that, you know, when kids to not tell them you should do this or you should do that, and let that cannon be shot with their own spark. You know what I mean? Their own strength, you know, rather than have someone push you in that direction. Like, I have 2 kids and, you know, I bought a keyboard. My daughter was like, I want a keyboard. And I was like, all right, I bought a keyboard. She kind of struggled a little bit with it. So she can, and I'm not pushing her to it. You know, I got guitars all over the place. And my son is, you know, not, but I want to give them the gift of music. So I play stuff for them. You know, I play, listen to this. I want you to listen to this. I want, you know, and give them that, because that's really where the joy comes from, you know. So many kids, I grew up in the inner city. So I remember being in school one day and we were going down the stairs to lunch, and there was this little boy on one side and we 2 rows, and I was on this side, and he was a singer. He sang. And one of the other kids was like, you be singing? Like, you be singing? You know, and the kid was like, yeah, you know, I sing. And then it started like this little kind of like making fun of the kid. And I remember instinctively, I was like, that's not okay. I mean, I was only 7 or 8 years old, but I knew that was not okay. And there's this thing in the inner city about doing stuff that's outside the box, as far as, like, you know, music, for instance, is a big, classical music is even bigger, you know. But like, I was playing the blues. Who's playing the blues in South Bronx. Nobody. Right. You know what I mean? Even though we were all singing the blues, but you know, nobody was really playing the blues. And so that became like a real important thing for me to try to communicate now to young people, that it's like, you know, if you feel it, then that's yours.
Right.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, you know, it's not just the inner city. I mean, I grew up in a small city in South Carolina, and I didn't fit in anywhere. Mm. No one understood me. You know, the black kids didn't understand me. The white kids didn't understand me. That, you know, I was in my kind of own world, especially when I was in my regular high school. Like by the time I got to high school, I started to go to two different high schools. I went to a fine arts school. Hmm. It was a public magnet school, and it was amazing. And then I left my regular high school courses, and I did all that there. And then I would go to this, and that was really the first place in my hometown where I really felt like I belonged, because right. It's like, oh, you know, here's a place where I don't have to wait till I go to college. Here's a place where we all love the arts, and we all get it, and we live for this stuff. We swim in it, and we can excel, and we can just sort of marinate every day in the courses and the music. And I mean, in elementary school, I had kids that wanted to beat me up. You know, they didn't like the way I talked.
Right.
I played a violin. They just didn't get it. And that was kind of tough, but I think I found myself in all of that. And I was never cowered by it. It's like, you know, you're really missing out on this, you know,
yeah.
I don't really care what you think, but it was a tough going just to try to figure out why am I so different than everyone around me? Why is it so hard to find a place where I fit?
Yeah.
And I think it's a really important part of your journey to just have the fortitude to stay the course.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'll stop talking in a minute, George, and let you ask. I apologize. But I also felt that way too, where I felt almost sorry for the ones that didn't get it. I'm like, how can you not listen to this and be blown away? And then why are you even talking? You know, because people sometimes when you're listening to music and someone starts talking, I don't know about you guys, but that to me is like,
that drives me nuts.
I cannot deal. But I have my headset on and my wife comes up.
Yeah, like, you're not focusing on it. You're missing it.
Yes,
what are
yes.
you doing? Stop talking. Pay attention. It's so funny. All right, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, and I agree. It's that, and it's funny because there are times where I'm listening and I'm driving and I'm listening to a piece of music that I've heard 100 times, but for whatever reason that day it sounds like a brand new piece of music to me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, you know. Yeah. All of a sudden, my wife will start talking. I'm like, no. Yeah. But growing up, you had something that, you know, not everybody has. You had a very supportive mom, right? She really helped you out. Was there any point during your journey where you were like, you know, do I keep doing this or do I do something else? Or did your mom say, oh, okay, you need a backup plan, that type of thing? Or was it straight ahead?
She didn't really understand. You know, we didn't have professional musicians in our family, and my mom had two careers. She was on her second career by the time I was in high school. She started out as a psychologist and she was a computer engineer. My mom is all things excellence. I don't care what it is.
Well, wow.
You're going to do it at the top level, you know, that's my mom. So I learned that, you know, whatever I didn't come into the world with, I definitely got from my mom in terms of drive and excellence and precision and quality and integrity of work and all of those things. It definitely came from through the lens of my mom's influence. But yeah, she was concerned, you know.
Okay.
She was like, well, maybe you want to get a 9-to-5. And
right,
then you can,
right.
No. And I even in high school, I was like,
look
no,
at that. Look
not,
at that.
No, I'm not
really
going to do that. And she's like, but what are you going to do? I was like, I don't know, but I'll figure it out.
Wow.
You know, and I just had this sense of conviction.
Yeah.
I didn't know, but I was like, no, I'm not going to get another kind of job. No, I'm going to be a violinist from the start.
Amazing.
And, you know, then you get a little bit more reality as you're about to graduate and you are a little concerned, like, what am I going to do? But then these things start to fall into place. I mean, I'm a go-getter. I never leave it to chance. They don't just fall into place by themselves, but still there are a lot of unanswered questions. And, you know, it's a leap of faith and some wonderful things happen. You know, when I moved to New York to go to Manhattan School of Music, suddenly for the first time ever, I was a runner up at the New York Philharmonic audition. The very first time I did an orchestra audition, I was runner up at the New York Philharmonic. So I started subbing with them. And that was this major development in my life. And actually, I happened to be in the orchestral master's program at Manhattan School of Music. So it was, you know, I was concertmaster in the orchestras at Manhattan School as well, and got some terrific opportunities. Meanwhile, on the other sphere, I was doing a lot of solo playing, but I didn't really consider that a viable path. I was like, well, that's nice, but really, this is the only practical thing over here. Okay. And so I had an orchestral career in the beginning. But then I just was pulled to consider, like, you have to face this reality that you feel yourself as a soloist. And what are you going to do about it?
Uh-huh.
Are you going to continue to tamp that down and ignore it? It's like, now is the time for choosing, you know?
Right.
Absolutely. So
like the internal directors in me one day was just like, now's the time for choosing. What do you choose? And I was like, I leave the orchestra behind and I will be a soloist.
Wow. So when you made, because I'm scared just even thinking about that. But but when you made that decision, is it one of those things where you remember like where you were and that moment? Yeah. Really? Wow.
Well, it wasn't one day. It took me years. It feels like it took me too long. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I have come to understand that I needed all of that time in an orchestra for so many reasons. I'm never going to 100% leave the orchestra behind because it's so in my bones and I know the repertoire so well. I now accept limited engagements as concertmaster because I just love that repertoire and I don't want to say goodbye to it. So I think that the years that I spent playing in my major job, which was the New Jersey Symphony, you know, I played in a year in Spain. I played with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra for, you know, whatever. But the major job that I spent for 13 years was with the New Jersey Symphony. And I think I needed that time. I chastised myself for not leaving sooner. But in hindsight, I now realize that it was good incubation for all kinds of things. I discovered myself as a public speaker there. I kind of discovered my first entrepreneurial, leanings in that job because of various situations of, you know, grants that I received as an orchestral player there that I was able to apply to this and this and that project.
Oh, yeah.
So I kind of had a chance to try some things out. And then I knew I was building up to taking a leave of absence, which I knew I was not going to return from. So I decided that I would not take that leave of absence until I was sure. And I knew I wasn't coming back, but I didn't communicate that to anyone. And I just wanted to try it out. It was a major test balloon.
Yeah.
And at the end of the second year, they said, okay, well, come on back. I said, well, actually, thank you very much. But But the first year that I left, I mean, I'm very grateful for that time. And it was, as I said, it was... It made me part of it. It made me who I am. And again, I used to feel very self-conscious about being a soloist that started out as an orchestral career, but no one knows the orchestra better than I do.
That's right.
Because of that time, no one knows the orchestra. And I think that sometimes people who are just groomed to be a soloist or are groomed in a certain way, not with necessarily a holistic picture of the works. Right. But I think that it's a really very special opportunity to be able to know a composer in as many genres of that composer as possible. I'm not a pianist, so I will never be able to play the Beethoven piano sonatas and concertos from that perspective, but I've played the Beethoven piano concertos, all five of them, and I've played the overtures, and I've played the orchestral pieces, and I've played the string quartets. So I feel like when I stand up to play the Beethoven violin concerto, I have that much more information in my cells about what this music is.
The essence of it in every way.
And I feel really good about that. It took me a while to realize, again, like I said in the beginning, there's no one path to get to anything. and I really value my path, but it was the right thing for me to do. I am a thinker beyond, a setting where, you know, where everything is predetermined and predecided, and I don't have a part of that process. That's not who I am. I'm someone that likes to determine my own destiny, to determine what music I'm going to play, dream up projects. And I live the life of doing that, creating as I see fit.
I love that. And don't you feel that like sometimes when you're in it, you know, when you're in life and you're kind of making all these decisions and you're thinking, like you said earlier, you know, you think you might have stayed too long, but then in hindsight, you look at it. And sometimes when you go through all these things and then you look back and it wasn't really, it was a beautifully crafted novel, actually, what it was.
Exactly, you know, right.
And it goes exactly the way it should have gone, you know, and it's like you need those kinds of things to make, first of all, you want to be able to have a life of challenges and you want to have a life of overcoming things so you can inspire others. And then when you look back on it, you're like, man, that was actually the right thing at that time. I needed that, you know. So I love to hear that insight on it. So thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely. So tell me how The Fiddler came about.
Ooh, now we're rock and rolling.
Yes.
Yeah, right? Well, I remember being, my husband and I were on vacation in Italy, and I got a call from someone who had seen my work as a soloist. I think I forgot to mention that one of my first forays into this solo world was this imagination project that I recorded right out of the barrel. It was before everybody was doing videos because of a pandemic. I did the first classical music video. I mean, not the first, but it kind of made a big, it was a big coming out of the gate moment for me leaving the orchestra world. And I was able to get 1 million views on that project. And so somebody called me when I was in Italy on vacation, who had seen my work both as concertmaster of an orchestra in Carnegie Hall, the New York Pops, and also had seen my imagination project and not only the playing, but what it did in the world of creating this sort of, you know, interesting splash and opening. And he called and asked if I would be interested. And I honestly wasn't sure. I knew Broadway was there and I admire it, but I wasn't totally sure if that was something that was my calling. And then I thought, what am I, crazy? You know, even if it's not something that I stay with forever, it's going to be an experience of a lifetime. And that was the biggest understatement of a lifetime. Because it is one of the grandest and most poignant personal and professional experiences of my life. I treasure every one of those days. And my husband had played a lot of Broadway as a sub. Okay. And he said, you're probably going to want to take a couple of shows off a week so you don't burn out.
Right.
I went in the opposite direction. I played every one of those 8 shows
with
bells on, because we had such an incredible and unique life experience for me. But mostly driven by the fact that we had an incredible company. Mm-hmm. And I was so inspired by, you know, Danny Burstein was our Tevye, and Jessica Hecht was our Golda, and the, you know, Bartlett Shear was the director, and this gorgeous staging, and all of the actors just brought the music to life, and they embraced me as the Fiddler, and they wrote music that wasn't normally in the Broadway
score. Right.
Me. And so then I had this clay to mold every night, and to be able to play off of one another, the actors. And it was this incredible laboratory of artistry that I got to explore every night, and a tremendous responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, when that light goes off, I'm the first thing that's heard. Ooh. And and I was the last thing that's heard at the end. And lots of moments in the middle where I was the only one playing, or where it was it was the poignant statement to something that's happened on stage. And it was a tremendous and sobering responsibility, but it was so deeply inspiring and so moving. And I just loved it so very much.
That's so amazing.
I loved our little Anatevka, and being able to grow as a company every night, you know. So I did have some pre-contracted concerts that I would leave occasionally, not in the very beginning, you know how that works, but eventually I had some pre-contracted concerts that I would go away for. And I hate, I mean, I love my concerts, but I hated being away. I always felt like there was I got out of the rhythm. Everybody else is in this rhythm, and we were in this rhythm together. And then it's like, okay, I got to get back in. Okay, we're in this rhythm together.
Yeah.
And we're doing this, you know, and he did this, so I did that. And she did that, so I did this, you know, and it's just, it was just this incredible synergy. And I loved it. I loved it so much.
It's a dance.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel
maybe
like.
Maybe I'm not being clear. Did I say that?
but tell us, did you love it?
Yeah, how did you really feel?
I don't think I actually said yet how I felt about it.
But are you the type of person that thrives on those moments, those pressure moments? Not everybody does. I mean, some people are like, oh my God, I can't do it. But are you the type of person that really like kicks it into gear in those moments?
I must be. I don't like huge pressure moments, but I always come to my best.
You just do it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
And, you know, there are like everybody else, you know, there are plenty of things that you're not happy with, but, but I found that Broadway was the most, you know, in many ways it was the most pressure of anything that I had done in the classical world because it's always on,
right,
you know, no matter what, you're a soloist tonight. No matter what else happens, you're a soloist tonight. The trains are running with delays. Doesn't matter. You're a soloist tonight.
That's right.
You know, shows a week. I mean,
Oprah's in the audience. You know, the Prime Minister of Israel's in the audience. Whatever. You're a soloist. Itzhak Perlman's in the audience.
Wow.
You're a soloist. Oh my tonight, God. You know?
That, forget it.
it was a really incredible. It was actually the first window through which I could meet the world as a performing artist, because I think, you know, the classical world is amazing and I love classical music, but I said from my time there that I think the classical world could learn a thing or two from Broadway. Just the idea, just who comes through those doors and who you're playing for every night. It was really kind of an incredible part of the experience.
And it was one of the most successful revivals of any show in the history of Broadway. I mean, it was humongous. I have a tech question, which is kind of going to show how dorky I am. But when you're playing, do you have a camera of the, because there's a fiddler on the stage, he has to mimic. I know that, you know, I think you spent some time with him, right, to actually show him how to hold it and how to, you know, do you have visual of him? Is he on a camera? Can you see him from where you are? This is my, go through my head.
No, it's a very good question, because my time on this show was the very first time in the Fiddler on the Roof history that they bifurcated the role of Fiddler. You know, there was, you know, usually the person that you see on stage is the person playing, but they went in a direction with the casting that was not a Hamilton style of casting.
Right.
It was a more traditional, I guess I don't fit that, you know, so they decided we've got a soloist, so let's explore the full extent of that. And we've got a dancer and let's explore the full capacity with that. So the dancer that played the fiddler, Jesse Kowarski, did things that even the other dancers could not all replace him on. He, our production, they flew him 72 feet above the stage for that interpretation of the fiddler's movement.
Yeah.
And that was a unique role in his case, and mine was a unique role in my case. But there was very little in the Broadway score that actually calls for solo music from the person, which is why it was a little easier to accomplish in the old days. But as they increased my role musically, they also increased Jesse's role in imitation or in interpretation of that sound. Everything, but more and more they decided to bring have the visual fiddler representing the sound that I was making. So I kind of took it upon myself to train him. He had a year of violin lessons in his childhood past. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't starting from absolute zero. So I just sort of took it on myself to do that. And it kind of became part of the language of the Bartlett Shear production, because now I've been hired as a consultant to train the touring fiddlers for each of the touring companies that have been out since our production. So it was unofficial in our production. It has become official. And so basically, from a technical standpoint, to answer your question, they had to figure out, I helped the company figure out how to make his violin stay silent, you know, because when you put a bow on the string, it's
going
to make noise. So I was teaching him how to look realistic, but not make sounds that would be so easily identifiable as not. So we came up with a variety of things. First, we tried putting no rosin on the bow, because the bow is designed to work with friction.
Sure.
And when you put the stickiness of rosin, that's what grabs the string and causes the friction. So we tried that. That's not enough, because you still hear. And so then I think after that, we put a felt like a secondary bridge. You know, the bridge is what keeps the strings up and allows you to put your fingers down.
Yes.
But we put a felt.
Oh, okay.
Underneath the string, so that they're stopped. You know,
they're
just literally just
a non-resonant thing. Right. And so that cuts it down a lot more.
Okay.
Not nothing, but it's no longer perceivable from the you know, from after like the first row or something.
Okay.
So yeah, there were some technical. And then because he does so much movement, and holding a bow is not, you know, very conducive to that movement, we put a string around his wrist that was attached to the bow, so that if, you know,
if he slipped,
it would actually fall.
Interesting.
So look at that.
That's why I asked.
You see, the little things you don't even think about, right?
Isn't theater, I mean, like, in musical theater is like so dynamic, like, and I, you know, I've been to Lincoln Center, and I remember I had tickets. Somebody gave me tickets at a job that I had, and I took my niece, and we were sitting like three rows out, and this orchestra came on, and I was first time, and I was already an adult, but I sat there and I was like blown away. Like, as soon as they went, and my niece just looked at me like she was like, I think I changed her life. I mean, she's like, it was like an incredible moment. And even on Broadway, you know, Broadway does such a good job of presentation and just bring you into this world that you shouldn't, it's not rational for you to go in, but for some reason this music starts and these images start, and you just, you're lost for like, for whatever the show is. It's just so, it's such a beautiful thing. I just love it. And that's just me just kind of going off topic. And
it's funny. No, that's great. I mean, the music, you feel music deeply, and I relate to that tremendously. I played an additional 6 months after Fiddler on Sunset Boulevard.
Right.
And that for that, we were on stage, and the orchestra became like rock stars to people who came, you know, to hear this production. It is so funny. You know, I would sign some autographs as Fiddler as people learned who I was through media coverage, because they couldn't see me. But Sunset Boulevard, they could see us, and I had an extended solo with Glenn Close and whatnot. But this one woman I'll never forget said, she's like, oh my gosh, the orchestra, this sounds so great. I mean, they should just have that. Like, just like, they should just have an orchestra, like where you can just come and hear an orchestra. And that would, like, they do.
Like, yeah, that's actually thing. Been, a, I think that was a thing before. I think before Fiddler, that was a thing.
Bless her heart, as we say in this film.
Exactly.
That's so funny.
People should just do that. It's like, people do.
What a concept, right? Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
And I know doing Sunset Boulevard, you got to meet Andrew Lloyd Webber, right?
Yes.
How was that?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was really great to work with him, and to, you know, the first time he came was our Zitz probe,
the
final rehearsal before we opened, and he gave me a sort of a special, you know, recognition of my solos that I think knocked a lot of the leadership's sort of knock them off their feet just because he doesn't often do that.
Oh, right. Wow. Okay. Okay. Wow.
That is awesome.
That's wow. Great.
So I want to, only 40 minutes. So I wanted to talk. I wanted to talk a little bit about the work that you do with the Music Kitchen. I know that was started in 2005, and I saw a lot of coverage on that as well. And it's one of those things that I've always, we just had the conference in Seattle, which was for the national, the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, which I'm a part of for their social media. And we just went there. And, you know, one of the things that I've always loved is bringing things to not just that community, but just to communities that don't have access to this type of music, you know. And it's like one of those things that you kind of like, why? Just this hasn't gone there. It doesn't make any sense. Because I remember listening to it in the cartoons as well. You know what I mean? And it was like wonderful to see Bugs Bunny coming out and being chased. And, you know, it was just like, it was awesome. So what was your inspiration for like saying, I'm gonna do a Music Kitchen, and how did that come about?
Well, the catalyst was when I was preparing for a solo concert and I was looking for someone. I was experiencing the death of a friend, you know. So a friend of mine was dying. It actually happened to be the pastor at my church. And I was so wrapped up with that because it was clear that he was in his final days. Mm-hmm. At the same time that I was preparing for a significant solo concert for me, and I typically like to play through the repertoire for people. And I usually do that for friends and colleagues, because who could stand to hear, you know, a violin concerto with no accompaniment? Right. But other musicians,
right,
you know?
Right, exactly, so right.
In a total pinch, since I was a volunteer cook, my husband was the coordinator of cooks. In a pinch, I played for the guys at the shelter, and I was feeling very guilty about it because I thought they would hate it, but they loved it so much. They asked me if I would come back the next night, and I did. I said, well, I can do that, but I'm preparing for this concert in a few days. I'm just going to play the same music again. They said, that's okay. We want to hear it again. And they were also friends with the pastor who at that point had died. And they said, will you be playing for the funeral? And I said, yes. And they said, could you play for us, you know, what you're going to play for the funeral? So was this cathartic moment twice. And it really wasn't just about that experience. That was just kind of the catalyst. Mm-hmm. But I love sharing music with people. And I had some unique life experiences that I think became part of the soup of my thinking. And that was chamber music parties. Mm-hmm. And there was one that I went to annually for a few years in Baltimore, and it was huge. It was about 300 people in this woman's mm-hmm. house, about 75 of which were players. And there were people that you'd never met before. There are people that you went to that festival with, or that you studied with in school, or that you freelance with. And it was just this incredibly passionate array of people wanting to play great works of chamber music before the whole thing shut down for that year.
Sure.
And I found there were people that were members of professional string quartets at this party. However, when people got together in spontaneous combinations, more magic would happen mm-hmm. in my mind than if you had hired a group of these people to play a concert. And sure. That really stuck with me. And mm-hmm. so when I had this experience of just looking for a place to run through my solo music, really my default went back to that experience. And I thought, clearly I need to do something to bring music to people regularly. And sure. solo music is not the point.
Right.
There's something magical about chamber music. Mm-hmm. And there's something magical about when you bring people together kind of semi-spontaneous, not spontaneously, like they don't know they're coming, but not right. that they, not people who play together regularly, because sure. at the time I had this incredible group of people that I was playing with in a trio. I was so over the moon to play with the two of them. It would have been very easy for me to just say, my trio is going to do this.
Yeah.
But I just had a sense that it's bigger than us, bigger than me. It's bigger than one group. It's bigger than this trio. And I started inviting people, but very, very special people. Like I just, it's not just anybody who can play the notes right, but it's, I'm looking for something more, that spark that I remember, mm-hmm. that passion, that spark that
right.
happens when certain kinds of artists come together. That's right. what I want to bring to them. Yeah. And so, yeah, I started Music Kitchen, and somehow it kind of seems like a blink of an eye. We've presented over 100 concerts, over 200 wow. top artists, and reached an estimated 30,000 shelter clients.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
That's so amazing. I mean, it's one of those things where, because you're sharing music, but you're also sharing a moment, you know, that they'll associate that music to a pleasure moment, because that's what music does. It, especially that, you know, classical music, just spiritually, just in just fills you. And so if you can just connect it to that moment for the, you know, for people that are having, you know, a rough time and experiencing homelessness, you know, it's one of those things that you really just can't put a price on, and you can't really even explain. You know, I mean, I've actually have gone through that. I was homeless when I was a teenager, and I remember a band came to this shelter. I was with my mom and my brother and my sisters, and this band came, and they were a funk band. You know, they were just kind of a funk band, but they were a family that would come in dressed up, and they funk. And for that, because we were all, obviously, you can imagine, you know, I was, I think, 15 years old, you know, as depressed as you can be, but if you can imagine how I felt when they played, I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to play like yeah. that. I want to do that. You know, it just kind right. of like, and for that spark, I mean, here I am at my age now, I'm still talking about it, you know, and I'll continue to talk about that. So that's just so well done. That's just so awesome. What's the website? I want to put it in the description and everything.
MusicKitchenNYC.org.
All right. So we'll put that in the description. Everybody check that out. And absolutely. We want to, I don't want to forget some, I don't want to forget anything. So you have a, we talked a little bit about this. You are now a filmmaker. And I'm very excited because I want you to tell us a little bit about your experience in Carnegie Hall. You know, oh my God, that's number one. And number right. two is like, then you filmed and you put something together that's very, very meaningful and very special. Again, with the theme that we were just discussing. Can you talk us through a little bit of that?
Yeah. So in Music Kitchen's 15 years, as we were approaching the 15th anniversary, I've collected very unique feedback since the very beginning. Colored note cards. I've just right. asked people to share your thoughts and feelings about the concerts, if you feel like it. And I have this incredibly unique body of feedback going back 15 years. And so when we were approaching the 15th anniversary, I decided I wanted to do something historic and unprecedented. And that is to choose, to ask 15 award-winning composers to choose among that feedback to set it to a song cycle that I entitled Forgotten Voices. Mm-hmm. And so it was very exciting to see that all come together. And for all these 15 award-winning composers, from Pulitzer Prize winners to, you know, to up-and-coming emerging composers to Rome and Guggenheim and whatever, all of these composers to be part of this project was so affirming for me, and to affirm the voices of the shelter clients we've been serving. I had the idea to premiere the songs for the shelter first, but then I also wanted to have a grand hearing of the complete song cycle when it was finished, all the composite 15 songs. So I approached Carnegie Hall about presenting the world premiere, and they loved the idea. They wow. supported, they came on and supported the commissioning process and presented the world premiere of the complete song cycle at Zankel Hall. So like a lot of other things, we were postponed in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to be in May of 2020, but I am super excited that it all came together and we sold out Zankel wow. Hall, and we had that concert on March 31st. It was wow. just incredible. And so as part of that project, since the comments span, I think what's unique about it is that they span so much time. This is not a fly-by-night operation. It was really something that spans a lot of life experience over a decade and a half. But because they are mostly anonymous and they go over such a long period of time, I had the idea to also create a short film that we would show at Carnegie Hall, where we would invite clients that we've met in the near term to come on camera and tell their story if they chose. Mm-hmm. And so fortunately, just before the shutdown, before we knew what was coming, we interviewed four clients that we had met that year. And we created a film called Face to Face, Forgotten Voices Heard. And I'm super excited about it, very proud of it. It's a mini documentary. I worked with director Elliot Forrest, and we co-directed the film, and I and Music Kitchen produced it. And I think it's heartwarming. I think it challenges our assumptions. It introduces people who would otherwise not, you know, sort of be ignored in our larger society. And I think it was the perfect complement to the song cycle in the world premiere concert. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, beyond the concert, I'm really eager to share it. And so we've submitted to quite a few film festivals.
What a few.
Quite a few, like 43 festivals around.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. That's great.
That's amazing.
That's unbelievable. So, you know, you've from beginning to end, amazing career, amazing things you have done and that you are doing. Okay. For the young artists that are out there who are starting out, who are, you know, whether it's music, whether it's, you know, acting or whatever it is, what kind of advice do you have to them to, you know, to overcome these obstacles, to get to where they want to go and to just live that passionate life that like you yourself are living and doing what they love to do?
Well, it just so happens that I gave a commencement address yesterday to 15,000 people at Delphi University. So this is kind of on my mind. Wow. I would say that, you know, there's no one way to do anything. As I've already said in this conversation, I think that it's very, very important to follow one's voice and passion. And I think there are a lot of things that will try to take us away from that voice. Our doubts, our fears, and particularly when you're just starting out, I know a lot of people have these artificial deadlines that they say, if I don't get that audition, if I don't win, if I don't get on Broadway by the time I'm blah, 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 then I'm just going to give up and become a banker. Or if I, you know, not that banking is not wonderful, but, but if people start out with a dream of doing something, they should do that thing, you know, and, there can be a lot of difficulty and disappointment and a lot of delays and things that don't turn out the way that you had hoped, but you kind of have to have a very, I won't say single-minded, but a very focused intention to see it through. And only if you love it enough, because otherwise it's just not worth it. And it can be very difficult, but that has to be enough that drives you. And it's not the starving artist model. We're done with that. Mm-hmm. Artists should be paid, for the beauty and the artistry and the skill that we bring to the society that we live in, that we're a part of. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, there can be difficulty and disappointment, and we have to kind of soldier through some of that. Mm-hmm. But knowing that, I think there's a certain element of not reading the tea leaves per se, not putting a finger in the wind, but you do have to kind of know the rhythm of your time and develop a sense. That's something that I said in my first commencement speech. The rhythm of your time is a phrase that keeps coming back to me. Hmm. You do have to kind of have a sense of it, have a bit of a pulse on it, but never be governed by something external. Hmm. You have to always be oriented towards your own voice and really be willing to stick up for it. And it's not always obvious that it's the right thing to do, but I think it's really tough. Yeah. I don't even know how it's hard for me. There's no straight line from when I started out to where I am now. There's all kinds of crooks and turns and things.
Exactly.
But I sort of kept my eye on I changed destination a little bit, but essentially being a musician, being a violinist, that was always the destination. And, you know, exactly how that played out, I shifted. But yeah, I think I would just say, stay true to your voice, follow Absolutely. Your passion. And it sounds like tropes, but it really is the most important thing that we can do. And I think that when we do that, what is pulled from us is mm-hmm. the most valuable thing we can offer the world.
That's right. That's it.
You know, when you're going through the workaday, when you're just sort of going through the motions, you're not as valuable to the world, though you may think you're doing the responsible thing.
Right.
I think that what comes from us when we follow that sense of passion is more powerful than anything.
Yeah. It's that self-awareness of knowing where you are and what, and it's also a responsibility as an artist. If you can lift someone up with your art in any way, then you better do that because we need it.
Exactly.
You know, the world needs it right now more than anything. And I think it's a responsibility that and I love what you said about the focus part, because I think that's really one of the things that we run into a lot. It's like the focus just seems to be a little bit, there's too much going on. There's too much distractions on these little tiny boxes and none of it is really, some of it can go out and maybe inspire someone. I do a lot of social media. I do that that's what I do for a living, you know, but I use it, the social media platforms, to try to inspire people rather than try to do whatever.
Exactly. You know.
But I think that the self-awareness is so important. I just want to thank you so much, because I mean, this has been like such a joy to have you on here and to hear your journey and that continues strong, and to see the work that you're doing, you know, outside of Carnegie Hall, in Carnegie Hall, and using Carnegie Hall and using your voice to really impact so many people that otherwise aren't going to either be heard or they're not going to be able to experience that joy that you can bring. So I want to thank you so much for doing that. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us here.
Absolutely.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure, such a joy. Thanks
thank
for
you
having
so much.
Me on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Woo.
Wow. How inspiring was that, huh?
I had tears. Like, I'm trying, like, not be a, you know, I mean, I don't care. I'll cry, you know, but
no,
I'm,
hey,
I'll
listen,
get watery it's, eye because it's like, this
it's
is
being
what I
moved.
Want.
It's about being moved by the moment and by the inspiration of it. So that was a pleasure. I was so excited.
All right. Well, we want to thank everybody for tuning in. All the information is going to be in the links below. Follow Kelly, Music Kitchen, all that. Get involved. Really, really, it's just a wonderful, wonderful journey. And we got to experience a little bit of that journey, and we're privileged for that. So I want to thank you all for joining us. We'll see you all next week. Again, live, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And for George Batista, John Henry Soto, this is Counterparts. Take care. And as always, peace.
Peace.